Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Gilbert Achkar, the scholar of Middle Eastern politics, who will explain why we shouldn't in all good conscience oppose the imposition of the no-fly zone in Libya. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the historian Joel Bainan on the labor background to the uprising in Egypt. Not much time for thumb-sucking today, so just a few words on the economic news. The news from the housing sector has been shockingly bad. Earlier this week, the Census Bureau reported that sales of new houses in February hit an all-time low, 250,000 at an annual rate, less than a quarter of the rate at the peak of the boom in 2006, and about half the rate of the early 1960s when the population was 40% lower. The wreckage in the housing market is amazing. By some measures, the decline in house prices is now more severe than it was during the Great Depression. Nearly 40% of the houses being sold today are sold by people who can't pay their mortgages. The rate of delinquency and foreclosure is declining, but there's still an enormous backlog of houses in foreclosure and a raft of human misery that goes along with all these depressing economic numbers. Aside from the human misery, there are two reasons why this news is bad in the macroeconomic sense. One, things should have begun to turn around by now, and they haven't. And two, no real economic recovery has gotten going in modern American history until the housing market led the way. Led, as in recovering first, not simultaneously. So the weak recovery we've seen for the last year and a half isn't likely to show any signs of juice until the housing turns around, but it hasn't yet. Oh, and for the 100th time, this mess shows the riskiness and stupidity of putting one of life's essentials, shelter, under the regime of speculative markets. Such markets constantly overdo things on both upside and down. So we had an insane bubble in housing that encouraged people to take on mortgages that they couldn't afford, and now we've got a miserable bust with people stuck with mortgages that they might have been able to afford once, but can't any longer. And on the other side of the coin, since you can't have a speculative market without a credit market, we've gone from a regime of insanely easy credit to insanely tight credit. Even people with good jobs, large down payments, and lots of savings can't get a mortgage nowadays. Just 5 years ago, your cat probably could have gotten a mortgage. It's nuts. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Gilbert Achkar. That was some of The Vision of Peregrine Wursthorn by the British Marxist indie pop band McCarthy from 1990. Peregrine Wursthorn is a reactionary British journalist. On March 19th, ZNET published an interview with Gilbert Achkar, the Lebanese-born scholar of Middle Eastern politics, conducted by Stephen Shalom. In it, Achkar, after offering plenty of warnings about risks and dastardly motives on the part of the Western powers who've been bombing Libya, said this: "I believe that from an anti-imperialist perspective, one cannot and should not oppose the no-fly zone, given that there is no plausible alternative for protecting the endangered population." That comment released a firestorm of criticism. Achkar, despite his long-standing anti-imperialist politics, was denounced as naive or worse. One poster to a Marxist listserv characterized his position as coming out swinging for this imperialist war. Of course, Achkar was doing nothing of the sort. This reaction prompted Achkar to write a follow-up a few days later. It opens with an excellent epigraph from Lenin's classic essay, Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, that dismisses the notion that all compromises with the capitalist state must be rejected. Countering that position, Lenin, now to many the symbol of doctrinaire rigidity, who was in fact anything but, said, to reject compromises on principle, to reject the permissibility of compromises in general, no matter of what kind, is childishness, which it is even difficult even to consider seriously. Anyway, I'm not sure what I think of this intervention in Libya. Generally, I'm reflexively against anything that involves the U.S. military or any of its NATO colleagues. It's hard to see how the armed agents of imperial power can ever act as anything but armed agents of imperial power. But in this case, they were requested by the rebels and authorized by a tightly worded UN resolution. So rather unusually, I find myself without a firm opinion on this matter. Which is one reason why it was good to read Oshkar on the topic. It's refreshing to watch someone think instead of repeating formulas by rote. So I thought it would be good to get the audio version of his argument, and, as a bonus, a lot of background on Libya as well. Gilbert Oshkar teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Welcome. I think a lot of people on the left were surprised by your support of the declaration of a no-fly zone in Libya. People are saying, don't you understand the nature of U.S. imperialism and all that? Why your support of that, and then how do you react to that criticism?
Well, the misunderstanding is already in your question. I haven't used the term support at all. The only thing I said is that one cannot oppose this demand of the uprising, and therefore one cannot just say we are against the no-fly zone at a moment when we have no alternative to suggest. I haven't heard any single person giving any convincing and credible alternative to a city of 600,000 inhabitants which was threatened of being crushed by the army of Gaddafi, which on the day of when the resolution was voted at the UN was on the outskirts of the city. And this is after several weeks of uprising and the number of deaths being in the thousands already in that country. As long as we don't have any real and credible alternative to offer that, what do you tell the uprising? Well, you have to get massacred and shut up? Or what?
How do you read the intentions of the U.S. and France and the others who are behind the U.N. resolution? What are their intentions?
The fact that these guys are absolutely have nothing to do with anything humanitarian or any idea of, that their intervention is motivated by the protection of civilians per se is, of course, something that I hope that no one need any longer to be lectured about. It's so much obvious that these powers are just pursuing their own imperialist interests. And in the case of this intervention, the point is that you have also to understand why they are doing it. They are now intervening in Libya because they want to exploit Libyan oil, as some people said. Well, the whole range of Western oil companies is present in Libya. I mean, there are only Western oil companies in that country almost, and they have the main stakes in Libyan oil. So there is nothing that these Western powers could have gotten more than what they had already been given by Gaddafi. Secondly, did they want to, turn the regime into a pro-imperialist one? Well, Gaddafi's regime has been closely collaborating with Western powers, with the United States of America, with the Italian ultra-right-wing government of Berlusconi, with Tony Blair and then the British imperialism, etc., for many years already. Not only collaborating with them in all sorts of, in the so-called war on terror and the rest, but even worse than that, I mean, Libya have done an agreement with the Italian government, Gaddafi's Libya, Gaddafi's government, through which they take back African immigrants, trying to get to Italian shores, and send them back without any consideration of their asylum requests and everything, which has cut down the number of immigrants in Italy tremendously. I mean, this is absolutely dirty reactionary job, and this regime of Gaddafi, is absolutely dirty reactionary dictatorship. So to believe that Western powers are intervening now because they don't like the regime is just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. So what is going on there? My view is that, I mean, we have to understand something. They saw, indeed, that a major massacre was looming on the horizon in Benghazi. Knowing the Gaddafi regime, knowing what he had already done in the previous weeks, the kind of repression, and knowing that Benghazi was the main stronghold of the insurrection, and by the way, it's not only in the east, now the city of Misrata is completely to the west, close to Tripoli, and is another of the strongholds of the opposition. Well, knowing all that, they saw the high likelihood of a major massacre taking place there. And therefore, they would have been confronted with that. I mean, to say that it's the same than in Bahrain or Yemen, it's not, I mean, it's not correct. It's not that, I mean, I am completely in favor of the mass uprising in Bahrain and in Yemen. But there is, I mean, the scale of repression of what that Gaddafi has been doing has been far superior. And therefore, if you had had this terrible bloodbath with Gaddafi consolidating his power, do you think that they could have continued, business as usual with him? I mean, even confronting their own public opinions, they would have been obliged to impose an embargo on this country, as they did, in a criminal way, over Iraq between 1991 and 2003. Short of being able at that time to invade the country, they imposed an embargo. And they imposed embargo on Iraq at a time when the oil market, and you Doug, know these issues quite well, at a time when the oil market was depressed. That is, oil prices were depressed. So you could afford, you know, to keep a country like Iraq with low oil production because of the embargo. Now, in the present conjuncture of the world economy, they can't afford to do that. They need this oil to be on the market because oil prices are already quite high because of the structural constraint of the imbalance between supply and demand, and this will go increasing, and at a time when the global economy is in crisis, as you know very well. So these are the considerations which prompt these people actually to intervene. So suddenly here they want to protect civilians, but this is because of their interests. They weren't caring about protecting civilians in Rwanda or in Gaza, of course, or in other places. Actually, they have been killing civilians all over the place. So we have to know that. We know that. We have no illusion. But the point is that if for once, because of their interest, they are protecting civilians. That is, of course, they are killing civilians by their no-fly zone. But at the same time, they stopped the advance of Gaddafi's troops on Benghazi, which would have killed much, much, much more people than anything these bombings are doing. It's not that I'm supporting these bombings. I'm just saying that in the situation where we were, we can't, as a left, say we refuse the no-fly zone. And the same way, we can't say we refuse to that the Libyan insurrection be granted air protection. This is the only thing they asked is air protection. That is, they don't want any troops on the ground. They have been very clear about that. Why don't they want troops on the ground? Because they have no illusions about the ambitions of those powers who are intervening. So we have also to take that into consideration. That's the key point that is being missed in all that. So now that's why I said I can't oppose a no-fly zone, knowing how this the aviation of Gaddafi is the decisive edge that he has, the decisive advantage, which is enabling him to win over. Now, beyond that, I think the issue now, I mean, is I'm against, of course, the Western powers managing the war there. I'm against them going, you know, using the resolution to implement an agenda which goes beyond the terms of the resolution that they themselves adopted, and I think weapons should be delivered to the Libyan insurgents, to enable them to fight the dictatorship, and anything going beyond a real strict and no-fly zone that is preventing the use of the air by Gaddafi should be rejected.
I'm speaking with Gilbert Ashkar, who teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Let's step back a bit and talk about Gaddafi. I think he has a lot of credibility in some circles as an anti-imperialist going back 40 years, but talk a bit about the evolution of Gaddafi. Where did he come from, and where is he now?
Well, Gaddafi, this started as a coup in 1969, a military coup led by some young officers who overthrew the monarchy that existed, and were inspired by the Nasserite model, you know, referring to Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian president between 1954 and 1970. So that was their model. And they tried to imitate Nasserism. At the beginning, it was a mixture of Nasserism and a right-wing version of that, because Gaddafi was much more socially reactionary than what Nasserism is. He had a lot more of Islam combined, religious dimension of ideology combined with his Nasserism than in the original, and also the fact that the Libyan social structure, the tribal Bedouin dimension, and all that is quite different from what you have in Egypt. And then later on, and this also goes through even clashes within the ruling group. But anyhow, later on he shifted to the left, even very radically to the left on the face of it, and started imitating, after having pretended to be a new doctrinaire of Islam, he moved into pretending to be a new doctrinaire of world revolution. And he started aping, the Chinese Cultural Revolution. You had the Green Book, like you had the little Red Book. Proclaimed that he applied direct democracy in the country. And all political parties and everything was prohibited completely. And he pretended that the state is just, run by the masses, the so-called revolutionary committees. Later on, the popular committees were, presented like some kind of Soviets in the original sense of the term, referring to what happened in the early stages of the Russian Revolution, So that's why it was presented. Of course, nobody was fooled. This is a country with one of the highest proportion of people on the payroll of security services in the world. As a proportion of the population. These so-called committees were actually, one of the apparatuses of control of the people and the state with all these security apparatuses, and the lavish spending of Gaddafi of oil money on buying weapons. In the past, that was from the Soviet Union. Later on, it would turn to Western countries also. So he in this phase of his, let's say, left-wing phase, he went very far in nationalizing everything, including, hairdressers were nationalized. I'm not kidding. At some point in Libya, there was something completely, from the start, irrational in the trajectory of Gaddafi. And this went on like that for some time until the Soviet Union, had its own crisis, and you had the Gorbachev and the Perestroika, and then Gaddafi went on his own version of the Perestroika, also imitating that. And ultimately, his last major shift after, I'm sparing you a lot of details and big shifts from Arab unity to African unity to Maghreb unity. Anyhow, his latest shift was when he accepted to turn completely. He was, in a sense, probably afraid about his own regime when he saw the invasion of Iraq by the Bush administration, and he just offered them, cooperation. And he orchestrated this mise en scène, which was warmly applauded by Bush and Blair, by which Libya proclaimed that it renounced to its program of weapons of mass destruction, and suddenly Libya became, a very frequentable regime for all Western powers. And I already mentioned the deal he had with Berlusconi, completely disgusting reactionary deal against immigrants. That's the kind of regime you have. So anyone thinking this is progressive, I mean, if this is progressivism, I'm not. I'm sorry. I mean, this is absolutely terrible, notwithstanding the fact that this is a terrible dictatorship, and that the people had more than enough with them. I mean, even if we were dealing with an anti-imperialist, between quote marks, that is, even if we were dealing with North Korea, for instance, which no one would describe as collaborating with imperialism, contrary to the Libyan regime, does it mean that you wouldn't support a popular uprising there against one of the most totalitarian regimes on earth? I mean, what is this logic?
What do we know about the opposition? Who are they?
The opposition, what do you expect? I mean, what do you expect from a country which has been ruled by the dictatorship since 1969, the same dictatorship, a country where every kind of there was no civil society, where every kind of political force has been crushed and tortured and killed and repressed, and even abroad, opponents were assassinated. What do you expect? And with a regime which for a long time pretended, to have invented a new left-wing theory and things of the kind. I mean, and a regime which has used extensively tribalism, throwing the country back back from a stage where, from the stage where it was in 69 when they took power. Gaddafi used this a lot. So what do you expect? What do you expect? You expect, the proletariat incarnated politically in that country? No, what you have is, a kind of big mixture of Democrats, intellectuals, and the rest. You have tribal elements. You have people from various social classes, bourgeois, petit bourgeois, whatever. You have people who are part of the government and who joined the insurrection, took position in favor of the insurgents. So you have this this kind of combination, which is the Libyan opposition, and which is united around a democratic demands. That's the only thing they have in common. They want political freedoms, free elections. That's what they have. And you have this kind of uprising. I mean, had the regime been less bloodily dictatorial, they could have said, okay, let's organize elections. But you never had elections in Libya. They don't. I mean, this is a completely totalitarian regime.
What was the basis of Gaddafi's support in recent years? Does he have a constituency?
He has a constituency like any state having oil rent. There is no oil state on earth that doesn't have a constituency. I mean, you can look at the oil monarchies in the Gulf. They have their constituencies. The Saudi kingdom, the worst anti-democratic state on earth and the good, great friends of Washington, of course, have a constituency. They can buy people with their oil. They can buy troops. They can buy troops and promise them high pay rises if they remain loyal to the regime, especially in time of need. Moreover, in Libya, you have a big number of mercenaries foreign mercenaries being used by Gaddafi also in his troops, in his forces. So he has a constituency, but it's a limited one. All reports include, the way the insurrection spread to the major cities of the country, and even in Tripoli, which is the stronghold of the regime, you had a movement which was crushed very severely. And, reports are there, despite everything, that, you can see how people are in a state of fear and terror there, except for the supporters of the regime.
Phyllis Bennett has a piece that argues that the intervention marks the end of the Arab Spring. Do you think this intervention is going to have an effect on the uprisings across the Arab world or not?
Okay, let's take the facts. When the intervention started, did you have a recession of the so-called Arab Spring? I don't like very much the term, but why not? What I would say rather the revolutionary process in the Arab world. Or did it go further? Well, what we have seen is further movements, not only an expansion of existing movements like in Morocco or Yemen or the rest, but even an extension of the movement to Syria, which until now was preserved. So first of all, this is factually wrong. Secondly, on the contrary, had Gaddafi been able to organize a bloodshed at a massive scale in Benghazi and crush the rebellion, you can be sure that this would have had a terrible effect on the regional revolutionary process. So it's completely wrong to say that this intervention is ending the process. That's not true, simply.
And you would say that the region is in some state of revolution?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, this is a revolutionary process. I'm not saying a revolution period. I'm saying you have a revolutionary process at various stages in various countries. In no country this has led to what could be called a revolution until now, including Egypt and Tunisia. You have an unfinished revolutionary process, and you have ruling classes trying to abort it or, let's say, to keep it within limits which do not threaten their social order.
That was Gilbert Ashkar, who teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. You can look up his pieces on Libya and many other topics at zcommunications.org, zcommunications.org, and his name is spelled A-C-H-C-A-R. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to discuss Egypt. That was some of the first movement of the Sonata for Cello and Piano, Opus 40, by Shostakovich, performed by the Boston Chamber Music Society. My next guest is Joel Bainan, who teaches Middle Eastern History at Stanford. In February 2010, the Solidarity Center of the AFL-CIO published a long report, of which Bainan was the lead author, on the fight for labor rights in Egypt. Given not only the recent uprising in that country, but all the loose talk about what inspired it, Bainan seemed like the perfect person to offer some perspective on the country, including the huge role that a decade of labor unrest played in setting the scene for the recent explosion. Welcome, Joel. There are a lot of people who treated the Egyptian uprising as if it came out of nowhere, or, you know, it was all Facebook's doing. But there's actually quite a prehistory of labor struggle going back at least a decade, right?
Yes, that's true. From about 1998, there has been a steady increase of collective actions by workers, strikes, sit-ins, protests, demonstrations, petitions. It amounts to well over 3,500 actions since 1998 and well over 2 million workers.
Concentrated in any particular region or sector, or much more widespread?
It's concentrated in the textile sector, which is actually the number two industrial sector in Egypt. The first is food processing and tobacco. And the reason for this is that textiles formerly was the number one manufacturing sector in Egypt, and most of the textile sector was publicly owned. It was nationalized in the Nasser period in the 1960s. And these are the factories that are being targeted for being sold off to private investors. And many of the strikes and other actions in these factories are either protests against the sale or protests about the new owners not abiding by the contractual conditions that pertained before the sale, which is the Egyptian law that they have to do it, but very often violated. Protests over workers not receiving annual bonuses, which they did receive when the factories were in the public sector and such like that.
What is the status of these strikes? Were they legal or illegal?
All of them were illegal. Strikes are, in principle, according to the old trade union law, legal now. That law is being revised, so we don't know exactly what's going to happen. But the reason that all the strikes were illegal is because it is virtually impossible to get a authorization for a legal strike. You need to get the permission from the national trade union that of your industry, so the national union of textile workers, let's say, and you need to get approval by two-thirds of the executive committee of the Egyptian Trade Union Federation. The Egyptian Trade Union Federation, since it was established in 1957, has been an arm of the regime. Almost all the members of the executive committee were, until recently, members of the ruling National Democratic Party, and some of them held very high offices in the party. So those people very, very rarely authorized the strikes. If I'm not mistaken, there were two authorized strikes since 1991, so everything else but them was nominally illegal.
And how did the labor unrest feed into the recent uprising? Were the unions actively involved?
They were, but in a very specific way. Workers participated as individuals from the very start, from the first demonstration on January 25th. It wasn't until January 28th that the movement was clearly putting forward a revolutionary demand, regime change, and so on. Once that was clear, the independent elements in the labor movement, organizations like the Center for Trade Union and Workers Services, the Union of Real Estate Tax Authority Workers, which emerged out of a very audacious strike, and then the leadership of the strike reorganized the union and took it out of the Egyptian Trade Union Federation, and they proclaimed an independent union, which even though that's illegal according to the trade union law, the government was compelled to recognize it. So these kinds of elements, on January 30th, in the middle of Tahrir Square in Cairo, which was the epicenter of the popular movement, announced the formation of a new independent federation of Egyptian trade unions. And some new unions, Union of Healthcare Technicians, Union of Teachers, the very large Pensioners Association, which is, I think, 8.5 million people and which just received the status of a union or a syndicate, they would call it in Egypt, joined them. And then representatives of about a dozen industrial suburbs of Cairo also joined in. And then they held another press conference on March 2nd where they released a statement, What Workers Want from the Revolution. And it wasn't, though, until the last 3 days of the uprising that led to Mubarak's dismissal that, I think this was on February 9th, that Kamal Abbas, who is the general coordinator of the Center for Trade Union and Worker Services, gave a speech in Tahrir Square calling on workers to strike in favor of the demand that Mubarak should go. And thousands of workers, in fact, did strike. And while we don't have proof of this, my suspicion is that the large number of striking workers was a key element in the decision of the generals to tell Mubarak that the game was over.
Libya has driven Egypt out of the front pages, but it occurs to me, I'm not really clear on who's running Egypt now. Who is running Egypt? What is the state like?
Well, the generals are, in fact, still running Egypt. There is a cabinet. It contains many people who are decent, including the Minister of Manpower and Migration, which in most countries is called the Minister of Labor. Professor Ahmed al-Bara'i, professor of labor law at Cairo University, who was, in fact, the candidate of the Center for Trade Union and Worker Services, the Independent Federation, Trade Union Federation, basically the insurgent elements in the labor movement. But the cabinet in Egypt has always been a technocratic body. The power has always been concentrated in the executive. Right now, there really is no executive, and the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces is playing that role. And you can see how that is working in a very negative way, in particular for labor, by a decision that the cabinet approved. It's not yet a law. It's not clear even how a law would actually be passed at this point. But they approved a draft law, banning all demonstrations against public and private bodies, which would include strikes. And the army has been calling for strikes to stop since Mubarak left, but in fact they have intensified after Mubarak left, because now that he was gone, people who had been cautious before felt that, okay, now we can go out and ask for what we need.
And let's step back and do a little economic history of Egypt over the last few decades, starting with Nasser. There was a nationalist developmental phase of Nasser followed by a neoliberal phase. So let's just run through the history of how Egypt got to be where it is today.
So Nasser and the three officers who led the military coup on July 23rd, 1952, which overthrew the monarchy, when they came to power, they really had no economic ideology at all. They did institute a land reform, or rather a minor one if we compare it to others, but that gave them lots of credit because Egypt certainly did need a land reform. Agricultural land was concentrated highly in the hands of about 12,000 families. Eventually, in the late 50s and in a more consolidated way from 1960 on, Nasser formulated an ideology which was known as Arab socialism. And that ideology was the justification for nationalizing every workplace in Egypt that employed more than 200 people. And that was the state of affairs throughout the 1960s and the early 1970s. After the 1973 war...
Now, it delivered decently rising living standards for a while, right?
Up until 1966. Economic growth was very impressive, about as good as it was in the middle 2000s with the neoliberal program. Average wages were doubled. Children of workers and peasants went to university for the first time. It did accomplish a great deal, but its problem was the problem of all import substitution, industrialization, economic programs. At a certain point, you have to pay hard currency to import machinery to move towards more complicated production processes, and you don't have any hard currency because you aren't producing anything that can be exported because the quality isn't good enough. And when that began to happen under Nasser in 1965-66, already the IMF began to step in, but Nasser had the clout to forestall them from imposing what they thought should happen. But nonetheless, by 1966, it was clear that there was going to be some new economic direction. And that was blocked by the massive defeat in the 1967 war, and that covered up the fact that the Arab Socialist Program had reached the end of its capacities. And Anwar Sadat was Nasser's vice president, so he succeeded him to the presidency. And he pretty much kept everything in place, despite making a lot of noises, until after the 1973 war. In the Egyptians believed that they won the 1973 war, and that gave Sadat the political standing to announce in 1974 a new open-door economic policy. And the essence of the policy was that, on the one hand, capital from any place in the world could come to Egypt and invest, and Egyptian workers could go abroad to oil companies and work and send home their wages, which became then source of hard currency, a very important one ultimately. As it turned out, though, not too much capital did invest in the 1970s because this huge bureaucratic apparatus set up under Arab socialism was still in place. It was very hard to import machinery. It was very hard to start a business. And then began this long period of negotiation, urging, cajoling between Egypt and the IMF and the World Bank over how quickly and how much Egypt was going to do to implement the full neoliberal program. In the fall of 1976, an IMF delegation came to Egypt, and they said, you have to cut these subsidies on bread and rice and cooking oil and so on, because that's what's creating your government budget deficit, and you have to get your budget deficit down, because this is what the IMF neoliberal program always tells people. And so that, in fact, cut the subsidies in half, and there were 2 days of rioting throughout the country, and then he had to get on the TV and say, okay, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm pulling it back.
I'm speaking with Joel Bainan, a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Stanford University.
And that was, in a certain way, a start point for what happened in January and February, because for the rest of Sadat's time until he was assassinated in 1981, and Mubarak was his vice president, so throughout Mubarak's time as well, it was in the mind of the regime that we can't go too far because what happened in January 1977 is liable to happen. And they had good reason to think so, not only because of Egypt, but because in Morocco, Tunisia, Sudan, there were also riots and demonstrations against IMF-imposed policies. So this became a point of contention, and of course the IMF and the United States government behind it didn't want there to be that kind of unrest in Egypt. And the turning point came with the first Gulf War, when Iraq invaded Kuwait and the United States formed a coalition to expel the Iraqi forces from Kuwait, which Egypt and several other Arab countries, including most unlikely Syria, joined. And as a reward for joining the American-led coalition and for helping to recruit other Arab countries to the American-led coalition, half of Egypt's foreign debt was canceled. The Paris Club canceled a chunk, and the United States canceled a chunk. And so now Egypt was in a position to move more, with more alacrity towards the IMF program. So in 1991, Egypt signed the Standard Economic Reform and Structural Adjustment Program that the IMF imposes on all countries that it can get its claws into. It signed another agreement with the World Bank, and it passed legislation giving a list of 300 and some companies that would be put on the auction block to be privatized. Over the course of the next 10 years, 210, I think it was, a little bit over 200, were in fact privatized, but they didn't get as much money as they thought they were going to get. Some of the bigger companies were not privatized. And then there was a recession in Egypt for the first couple years of the first decade of the 21st century. And in July of 2004, a new government was installed, led by Prime Minister Nazif. This is the government that Mubarak replaced just days before he resigned. And in that government of Nazif, all of the economic ministries, Minister of Finance, Minister of Investment, and so on, were in the hands of people who either had gotten PhDs in Western universities or who were CEOs of large corporations operating in Egypt. And all of them were also friends of Gamal Mubarak, the son of Hosni Mubarak. So the idea was, okay, this is the neoliberal gang. Gamal Mubarak was a money fund manager in London, so he knows what's up here, and this is the direction we're going. And they did it with a vengeance. In the first fiscal year of the Nazif government, receipts from the sale of public assets were 10 times what they had been in the previous decade. And they just charged forward, and they, the World Bank rated Egypt as top reformer in the Middle East, which in their terms, opening Egypt to capital and privatizing everything and cutting back on government services. I mean, that was right. Egypt was really charging forward. But that's the context for the labor revolt.
Who bought the privatized assets?
They were sometimes bought by Saudis, which usually resulted in huge labor problems. They were sometimes bought by Egyptians living abroad, which is what the Egyptian government really preferred, but sometimes they couldn't find someone. They were sometimes bought by foreign investors like Turks. Turkey and now China are making big investments in Egypt.
But the Egyptian army also has a big hand in the economy, doesn't it?
Indeed it does. We have no idea exactly how big. Estimates are that the army's manufacturing operations constitute somewhere between 10 and 30% of the gross domestic product. So that's not only armaments, which of course they do, but they produce refrigerators, they produce bottled water, all sorts of things which they sell to the general public. And they make enormous profits from it because the workers are army conscripts. And they don't even get the pitiful wage that Egyptian workers get. They get what military conscripts get. So the army has semi-slave labor to produce these things.
That's not textbook neoliberalism.
No. I mean, the army, and this is the army, since 1952, is the central prop of the regime, regardless of whether it was Arab socialism or Sadat's temporizing or the late Mubarak's neoliberalism with a vengeance. The position of the army as the key prop of the regime remained the same, and the army's attitude was, you all can do whatever you want, as long as the country is stable and as long as you don't mess around with our privileges.
You mentioned earlier that the leading sectors of the economy are textiles. I know Egyptian cotton is prized around the world, right? And food processing and tobacco. These are not really what you'd call dynamic sectors for long-term growth. So what can we say about the structure of the Egyptian economy? How well has it been performing and how deeply industrialized is it?
Well, Egypt and Turkey are the most industrialized countries in the Middle East. At this point, we can say that Turkey really is moving in the direction of becoming a full member of the global economy. Egypt is not. There have been some changes in textile production in the emerging private sector. in some of these either former public sector, now private sector, completely remodeled factories, or new private sector factories that have been set up in various special economic zones. In some of them, they use the most advanced technology, and they subcontract for the Gap, Levi Strauss, JCPenney's, and a whole host of American and European brand names. But other than that, there isn't much that Egypt can export. Well, there's oil. Egypt exports, half of Egypt's exports altogether are comprised of oil, even though there isn't very much oil in Egypt. So no, Egypt is not producing anything that would enable it to integrate fully into the world market. But Egypt is hanging in there on the basis of number one, tourism, and the tourism has been growing, well, until now, very dramatically. Lots of new hotels, new resorts opening. You can now fly directly from many points in Europe to Sharm el-Sheikh, go scuba diving, lay on the beach, don't even have to pass through dirty Cairo. They've also got similar facilities on what they call the Red Sea Riviera. So a lot of new investment, much of it Saudi, in that sector. Number two, tolls from the Suez Canal. Most of the oil from the Middle East passes through the Suez Canal. The price of oil has been up. Tolls on the Suez Canal, therefore, were raised. So that's another big source of rent. Number three, foreign aid from the United States. About $2.1 billion a year. And probably the biggest of all of the sources of foreign exchange and investment in the country, the remission of wages by workers working in the oil companies. So through the Hawala system, which became notorious after September 11th, they send their money home to their families, and that money sometimes is used to buy consumer goods, sometimes it's used to buy more agricultural land if they are peasants, and so forth.
Are there any forces within the popular movements, the labor movement, that have an idea of how to restructure the economy to work better for the people, or are they just sort of flying by the seat of their pants?
Well, that is the $24,000 question. If I were put in charge of Egypt, I would turn down the job because I wouldn't know what to do. It's too complicated. There are too many things wrong. It's a huge country with an enormously inefficient economy, enormously inefficient bureaucratic structure, and 35-40% of the population is illiterate. So we're not even close to having human capital that could be used to make this transformation. So effectively, there are two programs that the independent forces in the labor movement put forward. One is to restore the Nasserist program. And that, of course, is not going to happen because it can't be done, and it has gone to its limit. But there is still a lot of nostalgia for that period among either people who lived through it and remember it, or even sometimes children of workers who were active and big supporters of Nasser and work in that same factory as their parents did. The other demand, or the other direction, is very amorphous. In that statement that I mentioned before that was made on March 2nd under the title What Workers Want from the Revolution, so there are the normal kind of trade union things, right to strike, 1,200 Egyptian pounds a month basic minimum wage, that's about $215, abolition of the pro-government Egyptian Trade Union Federation, and then kind of in the middle of one of the more bread and butter trade union demands is the phrase equitable distribution of the wealth of the country. Any revolution that doesn't carry out redistribution of the wealth of the country on an equitable basis isn't worth its name. So, okay, but what does that mean and how can that happen? That's right, because the wealth of the country is so deeply skewed. At one point a few years ago, people were saying there were 100 billionaires in Egypt, but then 44% of the population is living either just above or under the World Bank's poverty level of $2 a day. So, yes, there needs to be a redistribution, but there's no clear idea about how to carry it out.
That was Joel Bainin, who teaches Middle Eastern history at Stanford. His report on labor in Egypt can be found on the website of the AFL-CIO's international arm, the Solidarity Center, which is at solidaritycenter.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this rather strange piece of music, Charles Ives performing his own composition, They Are There. It was recorded in New York City when Ives was almost 70. Yes, that's Ives singing, if you can call it that. The lyrics are a strange hybrid of pro and anti-war, pro-good war and anti-bad war, I guess. Not that it's always easy to tell those apart. Anyway, till next week, bye.
Boys rally round the flag of the people's no free world, shouting the battle cry of freedom. This cursed war, all started by sneaking culture, making slaves of men, goddamn him. Then let all the people rise and stand together and claim kind humanity. Most wars are made by small, stupid, selfish boys and groups, while the people have no say. But there'll come a day, hip hip hooray, when they'll smash all dictators to the wall. Then it's build a people's world nation, hooray, every honest country free to live his own native life. They will stand for the right, but when it comes to might, they'll be there, and the people, not just politicians, will rule their own lands and lives, as you'll hear the whole universe.